Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And we'll remember Aretha Franklin all morning. There's certain people, when they pass, you have to remark upon them, regardless of your profession or walk of life, just because they're sort of that transcendental during their time on this mortal coil. And Aretha Franklin, the greatest church singer who ever lived, was one of them.
Well, the question is, what's your favorite Aretha Franklin song? 312-642-5600. It's our turnkey.pro answer line. Which one's your fave?
I'm going to have to think on that.
Now you listen to me. I love you, but I'm the man and you are the woman, and I'll make the decisions concerning my life.
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your actions.
Oh, shut up, woman.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Yeah, think that you might gonna let yourself be free.
She set Matt Guitar Murphy straight. No question about that.
That film, that was her comeback film. I mean, people, you know, she kind of was lulled in the 70s, and she came back with that and Blues Brothers. 18 Grammys, 21 number one singles, twice divorced, a mother of four. But do you know, at the age of 14, when she recorded her first song, she was pregnant with her second child.
She had two children as a teenager. And
she was loyal to them and dedicated and didn't pass off motherhood to anybody. She raised those kids on her own.
Well, and came from the church. Her dad was a pastor, a minister, and that's where she got her start, following him around. An important man, a friend of Martin Luther King, which is a part of the reason that she sang at his funeral. What can you say about somebody with unearthly talent like Aretha Franklin? Although the interesting thing to me was looking at some of the tributes to her yesterday online. Yeah. People pulling different performances of hers, and I had forgotten about this one. But it was great because it was, you know, all the divas of the time together. And who stood out in 1998 when VH1 did a Divas Live telecast?
Yeah.
And it was Mariah Carey, Carole King, Shania Twain, Gloria Estefan, and, the Divas Diva.
We did Natural Woman at the end of the show, and that's Aretha's song, and Aretha rightly, you know, is the star of that song. But here we are on a stage full of divas, and Aretha's, you know, she, as she will tend to do, God bless her, sort of taking over. And then the part where Celine was supposed to sing, here's Aretha still singing.
And then Celine Dion went on to marry her father, and then her career kind of spiraled.
But, I mean, she had no formal training, if you think about it. She didn't go to music lessons, piano lessons. This was all natural.
I had no real formal training. My formal training was my ear, and that's it, right here. I love what I do, and I just wouldn't be doing anything else. In fact, I thought, what else would I have done?
And people in Detroit, absolutely. I mean, they had tributes for her last night in Detroit, around the country. But
yeah,
they loved her. You know why? Because she didn't leave. Normally, when people become famous, they bail. They go to sunny California. No, she stayed true to Bloomfield Hills. That's where she lived. That's where she raised her kids. And I love her for it. And I just, my favorite Aretha song.
When's Berry Gordy coming back to Detroit?
They're like my children. I love them all. But there are some that I like little more than others.
So sure. What's her favorite song? She couldn't say. Mine, not that you asked, but it's Son of a Preacher Man.
The only one who
daughter of a preacher.
It's a good rendition.
Can we play that for the next 4 hours?
No.
Well, President Trump weighed in, and he said that he hired her.
Well, I want to begin today by expressing my condolences to the family of a person I knew well. She worked for me on numerous occasions. She was terrific. Aretha Franklin, on her passing. She's brought joy to millions of lives, and her extraordinary legacy will thrive and inspire many generations to come. She was given a great gift from God, her voice, and she used it well. People loved Aretha. She's a special woman, so I just want to pass on my warmest best wishes and sympathies to her family.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Keith Ellison, the number two at DNC, congressman from Minnesota, who's now the Democrat nominee for attorney general there, he sat down with a local Minnesota news station to respond to the allegations that have surfaced this week that he had abused one, if not two, former girlfriends.
Is he married?
I don't think so.
I hope not.
Still looking for that special someone.
Yeah.
This started when the son of his most recent ex-girlfriend, or at least the most recent ex-girlfriend to accuse him of abuse, posted on social media insinuating, saying that there was tape that he had abused, Ellison had abused his mom. The mom sort of backed her son's statement, corroborated it, and it became a bit of a war of words between the two. Now, again, you know, I have no use for Keith Ellison, but just on the merits of this matter, the tape that allegedly exists per his accuser and her son, first the mom said she wasn't going to release it, it was too embarrassing. Then she said she lost it from a storage locker.
Oh, boy.
Keith Ellison.
Like another Missouri story.
Well,
then they found
there was a 9/11 call this is a dozen years ago, that was in regard to Keith Ellison, but there was no action taken. So there's sort of these instances, but not much to substantiate either one of them at this point.
He's not married. He got divorced in 2012.
Oh, great. I hope he finds that special someone. Here's his denial of the claims.
Did you ever abuse her in any way?
No.
Physically, emotionally?
No.
Did you ever drag her off a bed by her feet?
No, absolutely not.
She has said and insists that there is a video of this. Is there a video?
There couldn't be. There couldn't be such a thing as that.
And why couldn't there be?
Because I never did that. It simply didn't happen.
He must be used to being deposed, because that's how that interview went.
It does not seem real. I mean, he sounds like he's lying.
Well, now wait for the waterworks.
Oh.
Because he gets a little bit emotional.
Okay.
Let's get a little bit emotional when asked to speculate on her motive, the accuser.
I'd say, look, we loved each other. We don't have to destroy each other.
It's obviously very emotional for you. Is that what you think she's trying to do?
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to speculate on motive. I don't know. I've asked myself many times why. But not going to try to speculate on motive.
So now are you
don't
convinced?
You go there, man. Well, she broke her silence to CBS News and talked about it. And she didn't seem as upset as he was.
Right. Maybe the whole we love each other. Well, maybe there's a difference of opinion on that score. It was interesting to say we don't need to destroy one another. You can interpret that in a couple of different ways. One, you can say innocently enough, he's like, the war of words hurts both of us in the press. The other is that it's sort of a veiled threat. Like, if you continue this, I'm going to destroy you.
Well, she claims, I mean, that he looked at her and he said, hey, you blank, you hear me? Then he said, B word, get the blank out of my house. And he started to drag me off the bed. And that's when I put my camera on to video him. And she was going to be releasing that. But then she couldn't find it.
Right.
But she told CBS she still has it.
Then she doesn't have it. Yeah. So, you know, again, I am loath to give Keith Ellison the benefit of the doubt, but if we're going to look at these situations in a fact-specific way in this Me Too era, as I've suggested before, then we have to strip out the names, as it were, and look at the, you know, relative quality of the allegation and the response.
They dated for 3 years. Oh, I'm sorry. They dated for 3 years. Should that's the only time he got physical with her.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, I'm not at all persuaded by what has been presented so far against Ellison. I really am not. I mean, I think could he have told her to get the blank out of her house one time?
Yeah.
Sure.
That's when you know you got to go. How can I miss you when you don't leave?
That's not a abuse. That's not a Me Too moment.
No.
Get the heck out of my house. Okay.
Or they had an argument, and it's better sometimes if you separate parties.
So, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know if maybe her son initiated something that she didn't want initiated, and now she feels like she needs to back up what her son had to say. Or people remember it differently. I don't know exactly, but I have to say I'm at this point.
You're not convinced.
At this point, I'm...
Dan Proft has spoken.
No, at this point, I'm going to have to give Keith Ellison the benefit of the doubt, and I just hate to do it. That's what you got to do.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. All right, time for some raw audio. Raw audio that substantiates what we suggested about the individuals in question in two instances, very different instances. One involves Omarosa. The other involves the Chicago police shooting and killing Harith Augustus in South Shore, South Shore neighborhood.
Which
from
one
a few
do
weeks
you
want back.
To do first?
You know, lady's choice.
I think we should go with Omarosa.
All right, Omarosa.
Because this was a big bombshell on MSNBC last night. Appointment television. Right after she got fired, she was on the phone with Laura Trump, who was nice and helping a girlfriend
Laura Trump.
Out. Laura Trump or Laura?
Laura, like from Dr. Zhivago. Not Lalu. I don't even know. What are you talking about?
That's a Spanish.
L-A-R-A, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were.
How do you pronounce that?
Laura.
Party animals.
See?
Yeah, exactly.
She, don't you know, is Eric Trump's wife. And this is what happened.
What's the New York Times article?
The one that it was in the New York Times today. I guess you did with Maggie Haberman, or they wrote about you. It sounds a little like, obviously, that there are some things you've got in the back pocket to pull out. Clearly, if you come over as a campaign, like, we can't have, we gotta.
Oh, God, no.
Everybody's positive, right?
So they're offering her this job with the campaign a day after she gets fired from the White House and said, hey, you know, you don't have anything in your back pocket, do you? Because we can't have that. We can't have anything negative on the campaign. All right. And then they talked about salary.
The only thing that we have to consider when we're talking salary as far as the campaign is concerned is that, as you know, everything is public. And all the money that we raise and that pays salaries is directly from donors. Small dollar donors for the most part. So I know you were making $179 at the White House, and I think we can work something out where we keep you right along those lines. Specifically, let me see, I haven't even added up the numbers, but we were talking about like $15K a month. Let me see what that adds up to. 12.
Yeah, back to the envelope now. Yeah, sure. There you go, Laura. Well done.
I mean, this is...
So, I mean, I'm being bored to tears, so
okay,
what?
Well, because Omarosa said the $15K a month was hush money.
Wanted the best for me. They wanted me to come in, but she made it very clear that if I joined this campaign,
that I would have to be quiet. I wouldn't be allowed to talk to reporters. I wouldn't be allowed to say anything against Donald Trump. She, as she stated from her, in her own words, had to keep it positive. You can't be talking about those things. What is this thing you have in your back pocket? I saw this as an attempt to buy my silence, to censor me, and to pay me off $15,000 per month by the campaign.
You saw this as hush money.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Oh, the big conspiracy. It's hush money. I mean, honestly.
I got offered a job by the campaign, and I turned it down.
Well, she's an idiot. Okay. And they were nice. They were extending an olive branch. They were like, hey, you know what? We'll keep you on, but you can't say anything negative about the president. I mean, it's basic stuff. This is not another I got you moment. And the New York Times is reporting this morning, Dan, that she has 199 other tapes.
I hope they're as exciting as this one.
It just shows that she's sick. I mean, you don't do that to friends and colleagues, secretly record them. That's like a full-time job.
Well, remember the Saturday Night Live skit during the Democrat primary for president?
Which one?
The one in which, I can't remember the actor's name who played him, but who played Lincoln Chafee. Oh. He made some kind of statement, or his closing statement was, bye forever, Robert, everybody.
I'm leaving now.
Bye forever. Okay, so bye forever, Omarosa. Bye. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so now on to serious matters. And this is the Chicago police shooting of Harith Augustus, the barber in South Shore neighborhood, after he pulled, police noticed he was carrying a gun in his waistband. They stopped him. This is reflected in their report. One of the police officers tries to take his ID from him. He spins away from them. You see the gun in the waistband on the body cam video. He reaches for the gun, and they shoot and kill him. And, of course, this has generated outrage in certain quarters where any police-involved shooting, whether it's a good shoot or not, is going to generate outrage. But more audio now released of the cops' interaction after the shooting.
Yeah, and there's five different tapes that are released. One's a surveillance camera from far away. And you can see him, Dan. I didn't know this. They were trying to talk to him. They knew he's walking down the street with a gun. You could see the gun for blocks. And the officers were trying to, you know, talk to him. And then a woman, you know, attempted to restrain him, but he wiggles away, as you mentioned. And you can hear this all now because the audio is released.
Police shot. Shots fired at the police. Or police officer.
This is a police officer's body camera.
He
shot him.
Sarge, that's me. Yeah. Pull the gun on me. Yeah.
Was there only one? Wait, only one?
Just one? Who else shot? Who else shot?
He grabbed him. You okay? All right.
This is his partner.
You're good. Yes.
Get the gun?
Yes. Breathe in. Through your nose.
Why do you have to pull a gun out on us?
Breathe in through your nose. Out through your mouth. I feel like I wasn't there for you. I was trying to grab him.
I'm glad you're on my way. I had to. He was going to shoot us.
He was going to shoot us. Look at me. You're okay.
He pulled a gun out.
I know he did. Look at me. You're okay. Get away.
That female cop, the blonde female cop, I don't know her name, but if I ever see her on the street, I will give her the biggest hug. She protected her partner. She even said, I feel like I wasn't there for you. And she calmed him down. And then the crowd, this one guy started... like, that's him. That's the one who shot him. And she pretty much, she scared him away.
Get off the track, ma'am.
I'm a nurse.
We need you to step back, ma'am. Step back.
It's a crime scene.
You're back, ma'am.
It's a body. No.
get back.
I mean, police handled it as well as they could have, and God bless that woman. And then her partner, the male partner who shot Augustus, he did the right thing. And if I don't know if we're not seeing the same thing, but some people are saying, no, this proves that he shouldn't have shot him. He should have tasered him.
I know a friend of mine, we were talking about it. He's like, he's saying they shot Augustus 5 times before he ever pulled a gun. I'm just like, dude, I don't know what information you have that the rest of the public doesn't have. I'm happy to look at whatever evidence there is.
There's 5 tapes he can look at now.
But in terms of what's been released, I mean, come on. It's tragic. It's unfortunate that Mr. Augustus did what he did and that he died. It didn't need to come to that. It should have never come to that. Police ask you, sir, are you carrying a gun? Or they do an investigative stop and they, you know, want to pat you down or they want to take ID from you when they've asked for ID, then...
He was combative for the 3 blocks before he leading up to the shooting.
Well, it's one thing to be combative rhetorically. I can't get wrap my mind around those who would argue that anything other than a bad outcome is going to come to pass if you do not comply with police orders. You're going to get one over on the police? I just don't see it. It's so simple, and I understand the fear that has been created in the minds of many through demagogues and also some actual high profile cases of police misconduct. I get it. I appreciate that. You know, I haven't always been the biggest fan of police myself. My every interaction I've had with police officers hasn't been particularly pleasant.
Well, because you take an intellectual argument with them.
But the idea, though, that I would ever think to physically confront a police officer or police officers, plural.
Yeah, because there were so many different officers. As he walked down the block, you can see different people trying to stop him and talking to him. You can see the gun in his holster as he's walking, and they just want to like, hey, what's up, you know?
I just don't understand the attitude toward police. Don't understand that attitude toward police.
And after
how you
shot,
think this is going to go. I mean, how you think this is going to go. I really want to hear a response to that from people who take this kind of categorical antagonistic position toward police, who want to defend everything that somebody does wrong and in failing to comply with a police order, and will never give police the benefit of the doubt. As I say before, the person who has the worst attitude toward police, who thinks the worst of police all the time in every instance, that should be the person most inclined to comply. Because if you think they're that bad, if you think they're looking to harass you or abuse you in some way, then that should make you even more compliant, shouldn't it? Because you know that you're not going to win any physical confrontation with police. So why would you initiate one? Why would you escalate one? It is a no-win situation.
What I learned from watching these, you know, these 5 different footage, the raw footage, is that police officers, that was a split-second decision, and he made the right one. And also the loathing that the public has for police after the shooting, they're swarming in on them. And it's like, who's got the power here? Who has the control? And I feel bad for, I mean, that is a job. God bless them for doing it, because I couldn't do it.
Well, who has a control is a good question, because it's not obvious in the city who has control, because the police don't have the civilian authorities backing. But now that this, we'll see what Copacabana does in terms of clearing this investigation, the investigation into this shooting. But
and you can see him shaking, and the officer, he just, you know, the magnitude of what he did was sinking in, and his partner was right there with him saying, breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. And she was great.
Yeah, because cops are not getting up every day, it's thinking, who can I kill today? Who can I abuse today? Right. Again, high profile bad cops, John Burge, right? An obvious example in Chicago. But the idea that is somehow representative of 12,000 Chicago police officers is so illogical and absurd. Again, I just have a hard time figuring out why this is such a difficult conversation, why it's so challenging to get consensus on this when it seems just patently obvious, the evidence overwhelming. But here's the thing about this. If COPPA closes this case, the good news is, not just for those officers involved in the shooting, the good news is they can focus then on investigating the police officers who were involved.
The wrong pronouns?
Well, though any police officer used the wrong gender pronoun, of course. They should be taken off the force. But in addition to that, police officers that may accidentally be involved in breaking up a counterfeit goods ring in Pilsen, and somebody in this country illegally could be, as happened, taken into custody by ICE and subject to deportation, you know, for being in this country illegal, for police to even be in the proximity of intervening in such criminal activity, obviously is not consistent with Chicago values as defined by Tiny Dancer. So now Danny Solis and COPPA can focus all of their energy on investigating those terrible Chicago police officers who responded to or who were somehow engaged with DHS and ICE in breaking up this criminal enterprise in Pilsen, such that you may have a person in this city and country illegally deported. I mean, the horror of that. That's police misconduct in Chicago.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's being reported that more security clearances could be revoked by President Trump in the near term. Should security clearances be revoked for other Obama-era intel chiefs following Brennan, the names that have been mentioned, the names that was announced several weeks ago are up for review in terms of the status of their security clearances. Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Michael Hayden, James Clapper. Should they all go? Should Trump pull them all? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey. Pro text line. I got to tell you, the only thing it seems to me that these individuals are better at than lying to Congress is their little thumb sucking tantrums about what they believe they're entitled to receive. Clapper, James, clap on.
Clap on, clap off.
Clap on, clap off. James Clapper was on with Andrew Cuomo's brother yesterday. And
they look so much alike, too. It's freaky.
And, you know, it's just like, and just passive aggressive bitching. That's what you got from the former director.
Or then there's that.
National Intelligence. He's going to demand everybody tell him who they voted for.
Clap on, clap off.
If the president wanted to pull Mueller's security clearance, how easily could he do it?
Well, pretty easy. I mean,
to be a process. The president just saw him ignore it with you guys.
The president does have the authority to exercise here if he so chooses. Now it's unprecedented for a president to reach down and take such an action on an individual just because he doesn't like what he says, and that's really what this is all about. And I just think, again, it's not about retired formers like myself or Mike Hayden or John. It's what else could be done here. Mueller or ask that members of the intelligence community declare who they voted for. And if you didn't vote for me, you don't keep your clearance. I mean, where does this stop? I'm perhaps exaggerating a little bit here, but this is much bigger than just revoking John Brennan's eligibility or possibly mine or the others.
I mean, just stop. You're embarrassing yourself as if you haven't when you lie to the Congress, the American public about the metadata collection program. DNI Clapper, right?
Well, and then also former Navy Admiral William McRaven, he demanded that his security clearance be revoked, too, in a show of solidarity. Okay.
Oh, fine.
Fine. Yeah, and also, if Clapper keeps yapping, he's going to get his security clearance yanked, too.
Well, he's up for review, and it should be yanked. But, again, if they're not going to add any value, and I don't know what they know. The president, the agency, relevant agency heads would know more about that. I agree with the conversation we had with Andy McCarthy. In the conversation we had with Andy McCarthy yesterday, you know, case by case basis. Even if you find a Clapper, for instance, detestable, if he may have particular information about an ongoing operation that perhaps started under the previous administration, something where his assessment on classified information would be helpful to the cause of the Trump administration. Okay, fine. But in terms, but if the assessment is made that their insights are not needed because they can't be trusted because of their obvious antagonism towards the administration and the president specifically, then the security clearances. Where does this end? Oh, the slippery slope argument. Well, it ends with using people that we trust and in whom we have confidence. So Gina Haspel's been a CIA for a long time. Now she's a CIA director. And Pompeo moved from CIA to state. And he's been a member of Congress, West Pointer, James Mattis, John Bolton. So I have my national security team, Dan Coats, Dina.
Right.
I have my law enforcement leadership, agency leadership and law enforcement. Now, maybe I'm not exactly thrilled with all of them, but I've got my people.
Right.
And I'm going to lean on them. And if they're not providing any pushback that we are going to need to lean on John Brennan or James Clapper or some of these other individuals anytime in the foreseeable future, then the heck with it.
It's almost as if he got kicked out of his fraternity. You know, and a lot of Republican lawmakers, senators, congressmen are on Trump's side.
I don't know why former government employees continue to carry their security clearance with them anyway. I don't see Mr. Brennan attempting to help the Trump administration.
Mr. Brennan has gone way over the line in my view, and I think restricting his clearance, pulling his clearance makes sense to me.
The fact that he's out there every single day acting in a very partisan way probably doesn't help his cause.
It's true, acting in a partisan way.
It's more than that. I mean, Adam Schiff is less extreme and conspiratorial than Brennan. Per that op-ed in the New York Times yesterday. Okay. You may have missed it because I know you were reading the op-eds about
the newspaper. Op-eds.
Yeah, the 350 op-eds about how important members of the press are.
Yeah, that and listening to Aretha Franklin songs, yes. But what I missed that op-ed.
But I mean, Brennan is there's no doubt there's Russian collusion involving the Trump administration, perhaps the president himself, but senior people within his orbit. It's just a question of whether it rises to the level of criminal conspiracy. You know what a really interesting take on this?
Who?
As he always does. Scott Adams, the Dilbert cartoon creator, the Trump whisperer, as we call him. So he took to Periscope and posted a video. I think it was on Periscope or YouTube, one of the two, talking about how he thinks this all started. The Russian collusion investigation and Brennan's involvement in promoting the dossier and by extension the collusion investigation, which, by the way, Brennan takes credit for, perhaps more credit than he's owed. But he runs around taking credit for this. So it's not ascribing to somebody something they don't want credit for. He wants credit for it. Scott Adams saying this all started because John Brennan can't take a joke. Because John Brennan has no sense of humor. Listen to what Scott Adams says.
He said that a big part of why he started the investigation about Trump collusion was because of Trump's joke in public where he said, "Hey, Russia, if you've got Hillary's email, let's see him." I think it was Hillary's email, right? Now, how many times have I told you that one third of the public can't tell the difference between a joke and you know, something that's not a joke. I'm not kidding about that. It's roughly a third of the public quite literally doesn't have a sense of humor. I will go further. I will go further and tell you that I'll bet that someday, here's a prediction, this one you can bank on. Here's a prediction. Someday, 23andMe and other places that check your DNA, they will be able to determine if you have a sense of humor. Seriously. You will be able to know genetically if you have a sense of humor. So Brennan may have started one of the most important political witch hunts in history based on not recognizing a joke. And I'm not even making that up. I feel fairly confident in saying that what I just said is literally true, that the head of the CIA has almost destroyed the United States because he didn't understand an obvious joke was a joke.
I mean, it's really interesting. In addition to this contention that a third of the American public does not possess a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there'll be genetic testing someday to identify who has a proclivity to a sense of humor and who does not. It's really interesting. I think, and he sort of concedes the point, there may have been overriding motivations from Brennan to pursue this regardless, because he's a political animal and he's a dyed-in-the-wool leftist partisan. There's no question about that. So he may have done it anyway. But it is interesting that Brennan points to something as a red flag, and that Gus Hallvoter knows something about red flags. And see, I have a sense of humor.
See, oh, you're funny.
Thank you very much. So he points to that as a red flag, and you know, suggests that's one of the reasons that his spidey sense was tingling, and that, you know, obviously it was a joke. It's just interesting. It's just an interesting take on it. I don't know. Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Dan, wasn't your sense of humor removed surgically when you enrolled in Northwestern?
No,
how did you get it back?
I chose not to have the funnyectomy that most Northwestern undergrads get, no.
Okay, these thing, you know, they're all complaining about their security clearances. It's not a golden parachute. It's not white privilege that you get to keep forever and go out on the lecture circuit and make money. Supposed to be serving your country. They're hard as hell to get in the first place. If you have any smudge on your record, you can't get it. These people committed crimes. Not only should they be yanked, but they should be put in prison. And not the prison in Wisconsin, the country club that Chicago aldermen go to. They should go to the prison where you get surprised in the shower. And it's not a very good time.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. Vivid. Steve and Gary.
I didn't catch. Are you there?
Yeah, we are. We're there. I'm just having fun with the Steve and Gary thing. Sorry, I apologize.
It's Steve and Gary, okay.
Yeah. I really need a laugh track. Yeah, I really could use that. Thank
you. Then we know when you're being funny, right?
Right. Maybe I think I have a sense of humor, but 23andMe someday will tell me I don't. It's a good point.
But, yeah, I've often thought about what makes a liberal a liberal. And I'm kind of thinking, I agree with that, whoever that guy was in that recording. It's kind of a like an Asperger's thing, you know what I mean? They just don't get it. You understand what I'm saying?
Okay.
Wow, that's a little...
Getting back to Brennan.
Yeah,
I heard a tape of him giving a speech, and, you know, he's like, the Holy Quran says, and the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, and I'm like, who are you, man? How did you become the director of the CIA? You sound like an undercover Muslim, you know?
Okay. Thanks, Steve and Gary.
Get it?
I just want to say it one more time.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Yeah, I remember Aretha Franklin all morning. Queen of Soul. And got some good news for all those miniature Democrats in Chicago?
Oh, the little people that live in the tiny houses?
Yeah. Yeah, the Shire folks.
The Lollipop King?
come September 17th, Southwest Airlines announcing people will be able to carry miniature horses on board Southwest flights as trained service animals.
Right. But you have to have, but they changed their policy because I'm up to date on this because
sure.
I sometimes fly Southwest with Bunky. Only dogs, cats, and miniature horses. No longer snakes, peacocks, tarantulas. One flight attendant
I spoke
with. What
about slow lorises?
No. Said that she had a emotional pet penguin come on her flight. And they had the leash on the penguin and it walked down, and I said, well, you took a picture of it, right? She said, yeah, but I can't put it on social media.
What about a flamingo?
A flamingo? No. Mm. No birds. But back to the penguin real quick. And then I said, well, what? I mean, did he just sit there? She said, yeah. Then they asked for a cup of ice for the penguin.
Chili Willy.
Chili Willy.
Yeah.
Isn't that cute? No, but she said it was so cute. On the leash, waddling down. This is actual video from the penguin. No, waddling down to a seat.
Yeah, that's so cute. Except the person is a lunatic. That's the only problem with that story. The miniature horses, though, the little Shetland ponies. So
those are cute.
Madigan and Rom and Cullerton and Daly. When
Solis,
he travels.
Quigley.
Yeah.
They're all short. Who
they
else
can take their little ponies with them when they go on vacation now. Isn't that great?
Sorry. Have you ever seen a miniature horse? They're really cute. And they help people, you know, calm down, lower their blood pressure.
They could have like a little. We should get Shetland ponies for all the Chicago Democrats to ride around together.
So cute.
For the parades.
Yeah. Oh.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, who else might meddle in the midterms? It's not just the Russians. And by the way, an important pronouncement that was made by the federal government, including Rod Rosenstein, when he announced the indictment in absentia of Russian election meddlers, that, again, we, Dan Coates saying the same thing, we face threats from other parties who are on again, off again, antagonists of America. There are other spy agencies. There are other countries that mean to do America harm.
You know, like China.
Correct. And there's also people in this country that mean to manipulate elections, you know, like in the city of Chicago when Democrats institute the city key ID.
It's so ridiculous. And it's not taking off like they had planned.
For people here illegally.
Yeah, here, get a city ID card.
So you can register to vote.
ID, so you can register to vote and vote for the Democrats. All right.
Yeah.
Here's a pamphlet. Take one on the way out.
Rahm's having trouble winning the electorate as it currently exists, so he needs a new one. For more on the possibilities of election fraud, with just over 80 days before the midterms and then a couple months after that here, a mayoral election, we're pleased to be joined by Eric Eggers. He's a research director at the Government Accountability Institute and author of Fraud, How the Left Plans to Steal the Next Election. Eric, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, guys. Glad to be here. And yeah, it doesn't seem like I'll have to do too much work to convince people living in Chicago that the idea of voter fraud is something that could actually occur.
Well, you'd be surprised. We do have our skeptics, even though, of course, vote early, vote often is on our license plates. So how the left plans to steal the next election? Well, how are they going to do it?
Right. It's a great question. You just touched on a piece of it. And I talk about the Chicago IDs. In the book, of course, Chicago is not the only city. You see New York and San Francisco. And then you know, the second piece on that is whatever documentation is used to get these IDs has been destroyed. So there is no record of the citizenship status of the people with those IDs. But clearly the left is making a push to normalize non-citizen voting. You know, there's a poll that came out recently that says for the first time ever, a majority of Democrats believe non-citizens should have the right to vote. Actually, the official language is tax-paying illegal immigrants should have the right to vote. 53% of self-described liberals, 54% of Democrats. The head of the DNC, Tom Perez, his background before he worked in the Obama Justice Department was for a Soros-funded get-out-the-vote effort called Casa de Maryland, and that was their big push, is normalizing and advocating for voting rights for non-citizens. Tom Perez's hometown of Tacoma Park, Maryland, has been allowing non-citizen voting since 1992. So it's not only the past in certain key places, but it's the future. And this is just part of the hydra of organized efforts on the part of the left, with Tom Perez as being the official policy spokesperson. And then you've got Soros-funded groups that do two things. They fight against any effort to increase election security. Ohio recently had to fight Soros-funded efforts to both implement and continue its voter ID law, as well as remove illegal voters from the voting rolls. But at the same time, they then fund groups like Acorn and La Raza, who go out and roust up as many voters as possible, regardless of the legality of their status. As you guys know, why did Acorn and La Raza change their name? Because of the chronic affiliation and association with voter fraud. So I think that's sort of the organized infrastructure that I talk about in the book. And then, there's a lot of other incidental examples that just show how the vulnerabilities that continue to exist are manipulated and exploited.
Can you give me a ballpark range of how many illegal immigrants vote?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's some stats that show as many as 3 million. That was an academic study actually from the 2008 election. There's increasingly evidence, the Secretary of State in Pennsylvania resigned after people asked questions after the 2016 election, because there's evidence that as many as 100,000 non-citizens were on the rolls and possibly voted in the 2016 election. I mean, the reality is this. There's 248 counties in this country with more registered voters than citizens of legal voting age. So we've clearly got some problems. The Obama Commission on Election Administration has estimated that as many as 16 million voter registrations in this country are inaccurate or flawed. The Pew Center found there might be as many as 24 million. So, yeah, we've got massive problems. And when it's as easy to register to vote as getting a driver's license, and the threshold to get a driver's license is not the same as the threshold to register to vote, you've got a situation where it's rife for the possibility for fraud.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Eric. If we institute something like voter ID laws, then we're discouraging people from voting, particularly minorities, because apparently that's somehow discriminatory to them. Like voter ID, like them producing an ID is different than a white person producing an ID. There's some kind of different threshold, as I understand it from the left. I don't really understand it, though. But voter ID laws.
Yeah, Dan, I'm going to have to ask you not to use, racially inflammatory rhetoric on the program.
Yeah, white. Was white, was that the thing that offended you?
I don't want to get into my intersectionality, but the point is that it's clearly, what you just said, you hear that it's racist all the time, even though, and I know you guys know this, states like Alabama and Georgia and Ohio have actually seen increases in minority turnout after they've implemented voter ID laws. So there's no evidence to support that voter ID suppresses or oppresses minority turnout. And if you wanted to get on an airplane, or if you wanted to actually go to the Democratic National Convention in 2016, you'd needed a driver's license. So I don't know why it's racist to think that, if any everyday items like that are somehow different than voting.
What about the idea of just moving voters around where they're needed most? We saw that in the presidential election with some undercover video by James O'Keefe and company of our friend here, convicted felon Creamy Bob, husband of Calamity Jan Schakowsky here. He and an associate wanting to import people from places like Illinois to vote in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin obviously was a more competitive state, closer state, so he needed the people to be registered and vote in Wisconsin, even though they're Illinois residents. So what about just, kind of highest best use of the voter that's, in this mobile society in which we live?
Hey, I'm a sports fan, and a lot of teams are embracing analytics these days. So, of course, why would we not think that people that administer elections or people that run political parties would do the same thing? No, I mean, my mother-in-law lives in Columbus, Ohio, and I told her I was working on a book on voter fraud, and she said she knew people that would get on the buses all the time in the 70s. So this is clearly a thing. O'Keefe's video shows that you've got party officials that admit that this is an action that they take. And the reality is why can they do that? because the system is so vulnerable. You know, in the city of New York, which I think has similar composition and vulnerabilities to Chicago, the city said, hey, we've heard so many problems about the way elections are administered. Let's figure out just how big of a problem this is. So they actually sent undercover investigators to see, and they sent undercover investigators to vote on behalf of felons, dead people, and people that no longer resided in the state. And so they tried to cast a total of 63 ballots on behalf of people that shouldn't be voting. Well, 61 of those ballots were successful. And one of the only two that was not successful is because the undercover agent was attempting to cast a ballot on behalf of a felon who was actually, I believe, still incarcerated. And only because the felon's mother was working the polling place was the person unsuccessful in terms of casting the vote. So you've got issues where polling people are actually, and this is documented in the New York report, they even encourage people like, well, you can't vote here, but maybe you should go here and just claim, you know, give it a shot.
Well,
so, yeah,
the
bias is not towards the bias is not towards prosecuting voter fraud. Let's put it that way.
Well, it seems to me that the Sandinista mayor of New York has the answer to that. You just do the voter registration drives inside the prisons.
No, I mean, it's funny, but it's true.
He did that?
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the new push, right? And so that's the thing. So what does the future look like? What are the Democrats clearly targeting? They're targeting allowing non-citizens and illegal immigrants to be able to vote. I mean, luckily, they're not able to vote in federal elections, but that may change. You're going to see a push to that. And you're seeing, the demographics. They want to get felons to vote. I mean, any population that's going to disproportionately favor the Democratic Party, you're now seeing Democratic officials openly and outwardly say, why don't we get these people the right to vote now? And it's because, and you guys know this, I mean, whatever you want to say about the current presidential administration, there's a level of vitriol and hatred towards this administration, the likes of which I've never seen. So I don't think anybody questions this idea of motivation on behalf of Democrats to do whatever it takes to flip the House and the Senate this midterm cycle, impeach the president, block Supreme Court nominations, abolish ICE, the laundry list of activities. So, are they motivated? Yes. Does the opportunity exist? Yes. So I think it's as simple as, I think people need to wake up and realize just how big of a problem this may be.
Well, what can Republican leaders do to push back to have skin in this game?
Yeah, before Nicholas.
To try and grow their base.
Before Nicolas Maduro is elected president of the United States.
I think really there's a couple of things. Requiring ID, being able to push back and knock down the false narrative that requiring ID is somehow racially suppressive is one. I think you've got to support states like Ohio and Indiana that have been able to go through and fight Soros-funded challenges to do it, but they've been able to go through and say, listen, we want to make sure that people that shouldn't be casting ballots in our state aren't actually on our voter rolls. It's a novel concept, but it's considered to be highly controversial by people on the left. So states got to be able to clean up their voter rolls. And as other people have said, why can't we have some level of verification at the federal level of citizenship when you register to vote? I mean, that doesn't happen. That's why people call registering to vote an honor system. And here's the irony, really, for people that are truly progressives at heart and, believe in these humanist ideals. These vulnerabilities that the left has fought to make sure they still exist, they end up exploiting and victimizing the most vulnerable population. So non-citizens end up becoming the unwitting victims of these Soros-funded groups because they register to vote just when they check a box on their driver's license. And they don't necessarily know that they're committing a crime, but by doing that, it actually means they can never become naturalized citizens, and they may even face deportation. Senior citizens get their ballots harvested all the time in a practice called granny farming. You get people that go in, they pay the residents, the people that work at these residential facilities, and they're filling out the ballots, or people go in and just befriend these large communities of senior citizens. So, I think we've got to wake up and say, listen, we've got major problems, so we need to fight for enforcement at the local, state, and federal level. And then also election lawyers. I mean, the majority of problems that I document in my book were actually not caught by elections officials, but by people that were working on behalf of campaigns, and then ultimately by local media that followed up. So I would say lawyers, let's make sure you've got people that are working with the election offices to make sure the elections are as fair and accurate as possible.
Yeah, ballot integrity programs in states that have a Republican Party, Illinois, unfortunately, not one of them. But it's really interesting, too, in the timing of this, not just because we're 80 days from an election, but also because we're so focused, understandably so, on foreign interference in our elections. Okay, so let's have a conversation about interference in our elections writ large, foreign and domestic. So the timing of this book couldn't be better. He's Eric Eggers, research director at the Government Accountability Institute. The book, Fraud, How the Left Plans to Steal the Next Election. Eric, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, it was great to be here. Thanks, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're talking election fraud issues. Take a call real quick. Candace and DuPage on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm off to the ballot judge in DuPage, and I find it very disappointing and disheartening how many people don't ask for the simplest things. Like when I lived in Cook County, I was always asked my address, and you're supposed to ask the name and address, and half the time they don't ask for the address, which I just think is like a second way to verify, especially since so many people have the same last name and have the same name. And the other thing is, you know, we get these scumbag lawyers who, I mean, I've seen it all, who bring in these people can hardly speak. I mean, they don't even speak any English, and they're being coaxed. And I mean, I see that all the time.
Well, those are called
especially
the
over
candidates.
In Addison. Yeah. Huh?
Those are the candidates.
Yeah, especially like over in
ward bosses.
Especially over in Addison and neighborhoods like that. That's where they linger. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to say is, you know who wants to show their ID the most? Who practically force it on you? And I just think it's so endearing.
People that just become so, United States citizens?
No. People from the Middle East who have to show, well, they show their, you know, IDs to vote over there. But they, because they have such complicated names and we're not used to them, they always, like, put out their driver's license so we can spell it. And they have no issue. I mean, you know, they have zero issue with showing their ID. So, and most people don't. Over 80% of people want voter ID. So I really think the GOP needs to push it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So, suggestion that more security clearances will be revoked in the not-too-distant future. Other Obama-era apparatchiks that headed intel agencies on the chopping block, potentially, including clap on, clap off Jim Clapper, Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Michael Hayden, Sally Yates. This is like electric company. I say the first name, you say the last name. Jim Clapper was on with Andy Cuomo's brother on CNN.
One of those Cuomo. They all look the same. They are brothers, but still.
Yeah, one of them said America's never been great, and the other is the governor of New York or vice versa. I don't know. I can't keep track of it. Clapper had this to say about what happened to his buddy John Brennan. And what might happen to him.
If the president wanted to pull Mueller's security clearance, how easily could he do it?
Well, pretty easy. I mean,
to be a process. We just saw him ignore it with you guys.
The president does have the authority to exercise here if he so chooses. Now, it's unprecedented for a president to reach down and take such an action on an individual just because he doesn't like what he says. And that's, you know, that's really what this is all about. And I just think, again, it's not about retired formers like myself or Mike Hayden or John. It's what else could be done here. Mueller or ask that members of the intelligence community declare who they voted for. And if you didn't vote for me, you don't keep your clearance. I mean, where does this stop? I'm perhaps exaggerating a little bit here,
perhaps.
But this is much bigger than just revoking John Brennan's eligibility or possibly mine or the others.
Is it also unprecedented for a former CIA director to accuse the president of being a traitor and guilty of treason? Is that unprecedented?
Which is punishable by death.
Well, we're living in unprecedented times, it seems to me. For more on this topic and others, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report, of course, Chicago time, 5 p.m. weekdays. And the book, 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire. Brett, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
So what about this reaction from those who are having their security clearances either revoked or reviewed in advance of being revoked, who are, you know, kind of open and hostile parties of the Trump administration and have been for some time, and also I've found absent from their reactions any indication that they have anything pertinent to share that the country is missing out on were their security clearances to be revoked.
So there's two sides of this, right? One is, why do they need the security clearance? They're formers. And, you know, why do we as a country, and especially in the media, go to outrage level 11 at every one of these things? That's one side.
Yeah.
The other side is, you know, what is the bar? What is the standard by which you get rid of the security clearance? Like, they haven't explained what is the deal. You know, like, of these people, they all have something in common. They're all critics of the president. So that empowers critics of the president to say this is all 100% political. So they haven't set up a standard by which you do this. But I think the bigger question is, you know, why do they need it? Why is it such a big deal? And everybody is going to, you know, the corners, to the mattresses on security clearances for former intelligence officials who are speaking out against the president every day. The thing about, you know, restricting free speech, John Brennan has written a New York Times op-ed. He's been on MSNBC 5 times. He is Twitter, you know, tweeting away. If anything, it's empowered his free speech.
Yeah, that irony is lost on him, clearly.
Yeah, and then you have former Navy Admiral William McRaven. I'm sure you read his op-ed in the Washington Post where he's backing Brennan and saying, please revoke my security clearance. Do you think other people are going to be joining this solidarity against President Trump?
I don't know. Bill McRaven is really well-respected in special ops world. He's obviously the commander of the special operations forces that led the raid against bin Laden. For him to write this kind of op-ed was pretty unique. I covered the Pentagon for a long time. This is not a political guy usually. So he's stepping out here, and, you know, that raised some eyebrows in the community. There are others, you know, who believe that Brennan throughout his term politicized intelligence as CIA director and chose to do things and not do things to help the president when it came to characterizing al-Qaeda, when it came to, you know, issuing non-disclosure agreements for Benghazi survivors at the ceremony for their dead comrades. You know, like, he's done a lot of things you know, people had a real problem with looking at the intelligence community.
Well, yeah, the thing to me, too, just in terms of you were talking before about going to outrage factor 11 right out of the gate. 4 years ago, it was liberals writing in editorial pages in The Washington Post and The Guardian elsewhere. President Obama fired John Brennan because it was liberals who were tired of John Brennan, the John Brennan who supported enhanced interrogation techniques after 9/11, the John Brennan who lied about the drone program and the collateral damage associated with it, the John Brennan who lied about CIA operatives hacking into the computers of Senate Intelligence Committee members. You know, so but 4 years, but now, because he's a critic of President Trump, then, you know, he's a national treasure, like he characterizes Bob Mueller as being.
Yeah. So I think that there's, you know, obviously the security clearance thing is different than all of those past, critics would say, egregious, you know, actions that were perceived that way as he was CIA director. Steve Hayes has a great little thread of tweets in which he backs up all of these charges against Brennan. But then at the end says in Hayes's mind, a political hack that shouldn't be lionized, but that doesn't take away Hayes's disagreement with the security clearance pulling and how it was done. So you can have two of those things separately.
Now, sort of a related story, tangentially, Paul Manafort's case has gone to the jury. And yesterday, the jury asking the judge to define reasonable doubt. That's usually not a good indicator for the prosecution.
Yeah, I had Jonathan Turley on last night, and he said, you know, don't read too much into it, but... yeah, if you're a defense attorney and you get the questions and one of them is, can you define reasonable doubt? That means somebody has reasonable doubt.
Right, and then they also...
they want to make sure that they're defining it the right way in their mind.
And they also asked what a shell company was. I mean, there's just a lot of... I don't know. Do you think they'll come render a decision today? It is Friday.
I feel like this... I bet this jury probably is moving pretty quick. And the fact that they asked those questions... suggest that they're coming to an end. And usually when you get to the end, this wasn't a tremendously long trial, but it was obviously in the spotlight and people are not allowed to talk about things. When you get to a Friday before a weekend, it sometimes is motivational.
Well, where does Bob Mueller go? Just, I mean, to play out the hypothetical here, if Manafort was acquitted or even if it was a hung jury, where does the Mueller investigation go from here?
Well, you know, Manafort faces another trial in the D.C. circuit. So he's got, if he clears this hurdle, which would be significant, and it would be a, you know, a public relations blow to Mueller. Manafort still faces other charges, so he's not out of the woods. But it would be a big moment of not only... you know, questions about do you have collusion, but you didn't deliver on what you actually brought. That will be a big deal if it happens.
I want to get your take on the, you know, the hug a journalist day yesterday with the 350 coordinated editorials. I thought Iowa Hawk had a good tweet on the topic. If people who think the press is the enemy can't be persuaded by 350 identical newspaper editorials, I guess there's just no hope for them. so, I mean, is the D.C. press corps playing right into the hands of the deplorables with this coordinated effort?
I think so, because, you know, the hypocrisy is pretty big, too. And in that, you know, all the folks who cover media were losing their minds when Sinclair had this, you know, editorial about how they were going to be fair. And they had all their stations do it. Remember that? And everybody got so, so upset. Well, now you have all these exact same editorials in 300 papers, and nobody has any problem with that. The other thing is that, you know, where were these papers when the Obama administration called one of my colleagues a co-conspirator for reporting, you know, or I just, there is hypocrisy, and then it does fit into a narrative that, it's easy to pick apart.
He is Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report, 5 p.m. Chicago time. Weekdays, the book you want to pick up, 3 days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire. Brett, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Have a good one.
You too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Remembering Aretha Franklin all morning, of course. Queen of Soul. Straighten out Matt Murphy, Matt Guitar Murphy, and Blues Brothers.
Yeah, she was great. I still, I mean, now I every Aretha Franklin song I keep singing over and over again. What's your favorite one?
She'd Wish You'd Stop.
Wait, what's your favorite one?
Let me think about it.
Now you listen to me. I love you, but I'm the man and you are the woman. And I'll make the decisions concerning my life.
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your actions.
Oh, shut up, woman.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think. Let your mind go, let yourself be free.
How great was Blues Brothers? You had Aretha Franklin, Cab Calloway. Good
and
stuff.
The Blues Brothers.
Rachel
and
Charles.
A used car from a Mount Prospect police auction.
Yeah, that was the feature. There's no
question.
But
they asked Aretha, you know, what is your favorite song? Come on. Fess up. This is one of her last interviews.
They're like my children. I love them all. But there are some that I like a little more than others.
I like
her children or the songs?
The songs are her children. And she can't decide which one she likes best. And she had no musical training. It's not as if she did this all on her own.
I had no real formal training. My formal training was my ear. And that's it. Right here.
And singing in church.
Yeah, her dad was a
minister.
Baptist, and she was born in Memphis, right? And then moved to Detroit. But people in Michigan love her because she didn't leave. And I remember when I was a reporter in Detroit, we were always on Aretha Franklin Death Watch because she was sick on and off. I shouldn't say that, but I mean, it's
a nice eulogy.
I'm sorry. I love Song of a Preacher, Son of a Preacher.
The only one who could ever reach me was a son of a preacher. The only boy who could ever teach me was a son of a preacher.
All right. We don't spin records on this show.
All right,
I don't know. You know, take that to 103.5 or something.
Stop it. Breaking news yesterday was that the Pentagon says President Trump's military parade that was supposed to take place November 10th, the day before Veterans Day, has been pushed back to sometime in 2019. Now, a secret source in the Pentagon told NBC News that one of the reasons why is because of the cost. It had skyrocketed from $12 million to $92 million.
I love a parade.
Is that James Mattis?
A handful of vets, a line of cadets, or any brigade. I love a parade.
Talk about, going from the Queen of Soul to that, a show tunes. Holy goodness.
Mattis did respond about those numbers and the leaker.
Whoever told you that is probably smoking something that's legal in my state, but not in most states, okay? I'm not dignifying that number with any reply. I would discount that, and anybody who said that, I almost guarantee you one thing. They probably said, I need to stay anonymous. No kidding, because you'll look like an idiot. And number two, whoever wrote it needs to get better sources. I'll just leave it at that. And I don't know who wrote it. I haven't seen it. But I guarantee you there's been no cost estimate.
I wish James Mattis was the White House press secretary.
Oh.
I want to hear more from him. And I also don't think there should be any military parade until the Space Force is ready.
Exactly.
I want to see the Space Force in any parade.
And I want to see their new uniforms.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. Yes, the media is leftist, elitist, and out of touch. But the media in this country is not the enemy of the American people. We'll talk about that when Freedom Returns at 5.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Our latest regional property tax home sales report, Northwest Suburban Cook County today. We'll just continue telling these stories, maybe it'll get people to take stock of the largest investment most of you will make in your life and how that's faring in Illinois, what it would be like if you lived in another state. Not that you should leave, but it's hard to make the case to buy property in Illinois. I got to tell you, nobody is getting out of this. The failure of the Chicago Tribune series of articles last year about property taxes in this county and in Cook County and in the state generally.
Yeah.
It focused on just poor people who are being marginalized, being prevented really from the opportunity for home ownership and being disproportionately destroyed by the confiscatory property tax system here in places like the south and west sides of the city, south suburbs. That's true. But the rest of the story is nobody gets to avoid the beating. And I don't care how much money you've got. And so this is a perfect opportunity to illustrate that because, of course, we've got in Northwest Suburban Cook, Tony areas like Barrington Hills, or where Amy grew up in Mount Prospect.
Kind of like Barrington Hills,
yeah.
Just a little different.
Same.
Just, yeah. Our houses were not on 1.5 acres of land.
Upper crusters.
Yeah.
They had little ponies running around in your lawn. let's start a middle-income family.
In Mount Prospect?
No, and but in Bartlett, I mean upper middle income, but listen to this story.
Middle income.
What's that?
Nothing.
Funeral director Marcus Jaeger and his wife Leandra sold their 4,400 square foot four-bedroom, five-bath home a few steps from Bartlett Hills Golf Club in January of this year for $500,000, $502,000 specifically.
That's nice.
It's not nice if you know they bought the home in 2006 for $740,000. 12 years later, sold it for $238,000 less in nominal terms. In real terms, adjusted for inflation, that's a $425,000 hit. Their tax bill went from $11,900 in 2006 to more than $16,000 last year. They paid about $205,000 in property taxes over the 12 years they owned the home in Bartlett. It's about 41% of their sale price in 12 years.
I mean, how can that happen? I mean, buying for $750 and selling for $502?
Yeah. $750, which is really buying for $925 in 2006.
Oh, my God. Did they not keep up the property or...
Property taxes. 1.6% of home value when they bought, 3.3% of home value when they sold. When your property tax bill triples, it has a negative multiplier effect on your home equity and home value. You can't make, you can't even index or hedge against inflation with your home, much less actually turn a profit. Bartlett's effective property tax rate of north of 3%, 3.09%, is the highest in Northwest, among the highest in Northwest Cook. The only higher rate as a percent of home value is Barrington Hills, actually 3.67%. Again, that's 3.5 times the national average. And we'll tell you what happens when you start to get into the 3.5% of home value property tax range. Let's talk about somebody who's very wealthy. Retired Tell Labs executive Brian Jackman and his wife Mary Carroll paid $2.8 million in January of 2001 for a 7-bedroom, 7-bath, 7,600 square foot Barrington Hills estate of more than 12 acres.
Wow, nice.
Nice spread, huh?
Again, kind of like Mount Prospect, just a little different.
Like your ancestral home. So $2.8 million in January of 2001. Which is actually $3.99 million, $4 million in 2018 dollars. They sold it on July 17th for $1.9 million. That is a real loss of $2 million in 17 years. I mean, you have to have a lot of money or be really mad at it to not care about taking hammerings like the Jagers did in the Bartlett Hills Golf Club area, or Brian Jackman, the Jackmans did in Barrington Hills.
Gosh.
I mean, this is what the Jackmans paid $600,000 in property taxes in the 12 wow. years they owned the home. Their property tax bill more than doubled from when they bought the home in 12 years. $17,000 when they bought, $37,000 last year. Inverness, Scott Levin, paid $3.1 million for his spread in Inverness in 2008. That's $3.6 million in today's dollars. Again, adjusting for inflation, so constant dollars. $3.6 million in 2008. He's currently listing the home for sale for $2.6 million. A million less than he paid for it a decade ago. Bartlett Hills, Barrington Hills, Bartlett, north of 3% of property tax, 3% of home value is the property tax rate per home sales this year. Buffalo Grove, Inverness, Rolling Meadows, South Barrington, Streamwood, Prospect Heights, Elgin, Hanover Park, all at 2.5%, and a bunch of communities, including your beloved Mount Prospect, 2.37%. That's, on the lower end of the scale around here. Still, again, more than twice the national average. And the result, I mean, again, these are just home sales for the first 6 months of this year, so it's not necessarily a perfectly representative sample of the home stock in the community, but it tells you something. Home sales year over year. This, we're still in the recovery, right? We're at the top of the market. Home sales year over year in Park Ridge, the median price down 3%. Prospect Heights down 3.5%. Buffalo Grove down 5%. Ooh. Barrington down 10%. Inverness down 12%. Barrington Hills down 29% year over year. Something's happening. The math is catching up to people. That's what's happening. So I ask again, revolt or bolt on November 6th. I ask again, your pension, your home, or your job, which are you willing to sacrifice to the state? That's what it's going to be, as people are finding out.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Jim in Naperville, you know, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, there's no escaping it. We're backing our way out of the state of Illinois. We've sold our house, living in Naperville, renting, intentionally renting, and we're still paying the property tax. We're still burdened with the property taxes through our rent. So it's, you can't escape it unless you escape Illinois.
Yeah,
you know, there's just no ways about it.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, that's the sad reality. We'll talk to Vallis, as you mentioned at the top of the 8 o'clock hour, what he wants to do about property taxation in Chicago. Now, commercial subsidizes residential in Chicago, so it's not as bad as many of the suburban communities. But with, you know, multiple increases every year these days to prop up that house of cards in the city, it's going to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're losing tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm talking about at median home ownership level, a couple hundred, 300 grand homes. Just taking a bath. And you're going to listen to politicians tell you how they're the friend of working people? How they respect people who drop anchor in this community or this state and make a real investment in Illinois and stay here for the long term. They want productive people here. They're thankful that you're here raising your family and contributing to society. Are they? They're taking your stuff away. Kevin in Barrington.
Yeah, Dan, this doesn't just affect residences. We have a small business in Schaumburg, and we lease a space there. And they just increased the property taxes this last year by 46%. So, and we have to bear some of that burden, all the tenants do.
Yeah.
So we're moving the business in 2019. We're out of here. 46% increase in 1 year.
Thanks for the call, Kevin.
It's not doable. I mean,
no, it's, I mean, it's what it says, you know, at some point people say, you know, that's the biggest indictment. I've said a million times. The biggest indictment is people leaving who do not want to leave. No bigger indictment than that. But at some point you just, you know, people just can't make it make sense. It's insanity, actually.
The money's not there.
Or it won't be if I stay. Rich in McHenry.
Yes. You know, we talked about these property taxes. Everybody hates the property taxes. I mean, they're horrible. My property taxes are horrible. I can't stand it anymore. I've been fighting with the assessor for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can talk about this as much as you want. Why can't somebody do what they did in California and have a Proposition 13, and they reduce the property? It's 1% in California, and it still is to this day.
Yeah.
Even though California is ready to go broke, too. Why can't something be done like that here?
Well, it could be. Thanks for the call, Rich, and suggest as much here. We don't have the referendum process here is a lot more involved than it is in California. But Indiana didn't require a referendum, and they did it. 1, 2, 3. 1% hard cap on property taxes, a percentage of value, residential, 2% commercial, 3% farm.
And that's it.
That's it. Done. And
can you imagine how much more money we would be able to keep from our paychecks?
I mean, you're here talking about reducing your property tax bill throughout the Chicago metro region by a factor of 2 to 5. I mean, more actually in some communities. I mean, it's massive.
Yeah, I try to get my property taxes reduced, and I gotta
give people their home value back.
Yes,
their home equity back, their market value of their home back. And the other thing it does is it puts handcuffs on the spenders, starting at the local government level, and then you leverage that to force discipline, spending discipline at the state level. It has a nice daisy chain effect, which is one of the other reasons focus so much in on property taxes, because of how integral it is to keeping up this Ponzi scheme that's going on. And so if it's integral into sustaining it, the way to undo it is to rethink how we do property taxation and thus how we fund schools and so on and so forth. That's why this conversation should be central. And as I've said before, I guess, you know, if I can't get you to care about your home value, if I tell you you're going to lose $300,000 on your home and you shrug your shoulders and say it's fine, then I give up. Then you got me. You win. I don't know what you win exactly, but I'm, you know, you're not persuadable. Okay, fine. And maybe that's where the state is. I don't know, but we'll effort as long as I'm forced to stay. Mel in Mount Prospect.
Yeah, I agree with you about, and everybody else about the property taxes, but where I am here in Mount Prospect, and I was talking to a broker, and he said homes are really turning over, they're getting top dollar, and people are moving in. And then he mentioned, he says, I also have an interest, he said, in downtown Chicago. He says, it's incredible, people are moving into these places. I don't know where they're getting money from, but they're there, and they happen to be younger people. Anyways, that's my comment, but I agree about the property taxes. They're outrageous, but people have the bucks, and they're doing it.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for the call, Mel. Well,
Mount Prospect is strong because they have a great school system. District 26, District 214.
Median price.
John Hersey High School.
Oh, sure, yeah, Hersey.
Did I mention I was homecoming queen?
Yeah, a Hall of Famer there, too. Also for sports. I understand.
Got a great layup in the lane. Oof.
Mount Prospect, median home sales price year over year?
Yeah.
0%. Zero. No change. 285 last year, 285 this year. So there's, well that's not something to celebrate.
No, I know, but
I mean,
at least it's not.
Well,
it could be worse.
It could also, yeah, sure, it could
Barrington
be Barrington Hills. Yeah, but the point is, like,
who wants all that land?
Oh, the market's hot right now. So, right, but top of the market here, you're still taking a hammering. Yes, people are moving in. People are moving in who are making, on average, this is just the data, census data, 20,000 less than people leaving. And remember, two states have lost population 4 years in a row, West Virginia and Illinois, the only two. I mean, Illinois has hemorrhaged more than a million people net in this century. I mean, $30 billion in gross domestic product. So, yeah, you can go to certain neighborhoods downtown and say, oh, look, in like mine or Amy's, oh, look, it's hot. There are all these tower cranes building, a lot of rental buildings. And we'll see. Remember how that works, the length, the lead time on financing and so forth. We'll see how that ultimately works out as we continue in this property tax death spiral. The whole, you know, the real estate patter about how hot the real estate market is here, it belies a lot of the underlying math and the actual numbers in terms of return or negative return, more appropriately, that people are enduring. John in Palatine.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
You know, Dan, the one thing that you haven't talked about is the is jobs. And, you know, demand for housing's related to jobs. And, you know, you talk about some of the suburbs and, you know, when Motorola left because they were sold out, when, you know, all of these large organizations that have left is really what drives, you know, that impact on the housing. And, you know, how much state property how much state taxes, you know, are killing jobs, that kill our housing values, that end up raising the property values. I mean, that whole jobs thing. And you know what? Neither one of those two jackasses are talking about jobs, whether it's Rauner or Spud or Spalding, whatever you call them.
Yeah, Spalding.
that piece is missing so dramatically. If you Google Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and you look at how much fracking goes on in Ohio and Indiana and nothing in Illinois, that's free money that is just, no one looks at the whole state of Illinois and the whole impact. My house was worth $680,000 in 2008, and at best I could get $550 for it right now, and I live in Palatine.
Yeah.
And I'm in Fremd. That whole jobs thing, getting Amazon in here, getting all these big organizations in here, with Chicago, Dynamic, O'Hare, et cetera, but no one's talking that part of the game because it's going to be demand that's going to get the property values up, which, as god-awful as the property taxes are, when it's a lower percentage of the total value, then it's not as bad, especially when you're looking at other high-tech states.
Thanks for the call, John. Good point about the interconnectedness of it all. And since you brought up Spalding, you know, when Spalding sits around his house, he really sits around his house.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, continuing our series of interviewing the candidates for mayor of Chicago, except for Tiny Dancer.
Yeah, he still hasn't returned my call or email. He isn't right. I tried to drop off a note at his door. That didn't work out.
He's just scared. That's all right. I understand.
Pick out his little miniature horse.
We've talked to Willie Wilson. We've talked to Lori Lightfoot. And this morning, we talked to Paul Vallis, former head of Chicago Public Schools, former candidate for governor, former candidate for lieutenant governor with Pat Quinn in 2014, now candidate for mayor of Chicago in 2019. Paul, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. How's my reception?
Very good.
Perfect.
Good. So let me ask you this, because I think the answer is different depending on the candidate. So I'll put this to you. Is a Paul Vallis candidacy, is this about paradigm shift or is it about a personality contest?
I think it's about paradigm shift because I've always been more of a manager than a politician, and I think my candidate's about putting somebody in the mayor's office who knows how to manage multi-billion-dollar budgets with an eye towards long-term planning and the type of long-term planning that can transform those budgets into vehicles for investing in the communities and not just not just financial plans that provide for immediate political benefit while kicking the can down the road.
You mean,
and,
like,
go ahead.
You mean like borrowing $10 billion at right. Sopranos rates to try and pay down $30 billion in unfunded pension liabilities?
Yes. A little bit of like that. Or like suddenly promising in an election year that there's going to be $2 billion to retrofit CPA stations, or suddenly after the schools have been in severe financial crises for the last for the last 7 years, to suddenly have $1 billion to build new schools when the student population, at least since my departure, has declined by 70,000. I think they all fall into the same categories.
And so how are you going to bring up the sinking ship? What would you do differently?
Well, you know, the first thing that you have to do is you really have to look at the budget as a long-term financial plan, so that you're just not budgeting from year to year. Because when they do that, they have a tendency to, in effect, put off for tomorrow or for the next generation what they need to address today. And I believe the second thing that you have to do is you have to really develop a budget that's an investment document. You know, the city's shrinking. The city's lost 17% of its property value. Its population continues to decline. The school district's population is almost in free fall. And when a city is shrinking, the property tax base is contracting, which means the remaining property taxpayers pay higher property taxes. And the city's contracting because the city has not been focusing on public safety. They have not been focusing on basic infrastructure. They have adopted the type of tax and fee policies that are really extraordinarily punitive. I mean, look at the impact that the fees and fines are having on the poorest communities in the city of Chicago, where there were 10,000 bankruptcies, 80% of them in predominantly African-American wards, or where they're suspending tens of thousands of driver's license because people have been unable to pay these extraordinary, almost extortionist fees. So I think what you've got to do is you've got to design a budget that's both disciplined and a budget that sets spending priorities so that you are investing in the type of things that are going to help grow the city, that are going to help keep the population in the city and not drive people away.
I want to talk about CPS since you had time there, so you know the system. You just alluded to it. The abuse scandal that has been documented in the pages of the Chicago Tribune over the last several weeks, and really not, quite surprisingly, not received a lot of public attention, really. And I wonder if something changed from the time you were there until to the present in terms of protocols and handling instances of misconduct, whether by staff or students towards other students, or is this something that has been endemic for a long time and it's just been investigated and now brought to light recently?
Well, you know, there are always going to be predators. And I remember when I was in the Chicago Public Schools, our number of employees exceeded 40,000. Wow. It's as large as the city. So at the end of the day, there are always going to be individuals who are going to, who are going to do bad things. And the key is being able to not only identify them and spot them, but to have the capacity to respond when complaints are brought to your attention. I mean, I can't sit here and to say that in my 6 years there was no one in this school who tried to exploit children. But I can say that whenever we had an issue that was brought to our attention, we immediately investigated it and we immediately took actions. Our approach was to have a series of protocols in place that everybody was expected to follow in terms of reporting incidents, whether they were the incidents identified in the Tribune series or, for that matter, any sort of incident where a child or a faculty member was put in harm's way.
But in light of what the Tribune is reporting about laws that were clearly broken, reporting requirements that were not met, mishandling of complaints that were brought to school authorities, you know, as the mayor, I don't want to pretend like the mayor's not in charge of the school system like Rahm likes to pretend. Of course he is, right? And so what do you think should be done in CPS now in response to what we know was going on?
Well, let me tell you what we did and what they appear to have failed to do.
Okay.
First of all, we didn't have the law department investigate these type of cases. When there was a case brought to our attention, we turned it over to the police and we turned it over to the Department of Children and Family Services. And we had an office, we had a crisis intervention office that was almost joined at the hip with the Department of Children and Family Services. So the right entities immediately investigated the case. The second thing we did was whenever there was an individual who was a suspect or whenever a complaint was made against an individual, we immediately pulled that person out of the classroom. Even if we didn't have the evidence to move to fire them, we removed them from the classroom. I remember there was a floor in the Chicago Public Schools called Camp Beverly because Dr. Beverly managed that floor. And we had people who had been pulled out of the classroom who were being investigated because we wanted to err on the side. We wanted to err on the side of obviously safety. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing we did was 24-hour reporting and intervention. So, I mean, there was not an incident that impacted our children or, for that matter, not only in school but anywhere in the community where we didn't get a report and we didn't provide crisis intervention. So if you had a child who was shot in the community, we would learn about it. We would dispatch our crisis intervention team. So those are things that and the final thing is we were completely transparent. Look, you know, I was stunned that the mayor's spokesman made the comment that the mayor didn't know about the investigation, Tribune investigation, the findings of the investigation until like 2 weeks before the investigation went public, when they only filed something like 18 Freedom of Information.
Yeah,
reports.
Right.
Well, at the end of the day, there was nothing that would go on in the schools that were would not be brought to my attention because we had a centralized police command. We had the we would call it the school police unit, and I would get reports on a daily basis if a student was a victim of violence or any improper act anywhere, even if it was in their own communities. And we had the crisis teams to respond to it. And those are all things that I would restore. And I think those are things that for some reason or another fell by the wayside the last 10, 15 years.
Just, you know, people so they can get to know you better. Your wife, Sharon, is a police officer. Your two sons are police officers. I don't know if you saw the raw video released of the Augustus shooting, but what do you think the atmosphere is like for Chicago police officers out there on the streets?
I truly believe that what has happened to the police department has really been tragic because we have not been investing in the police department, and the police department has not had the resources, the infrastructure, the training, nor the monitoring to be effective and to be held fully accountable. You know, when you have 2,000 fewer officers than were at one time in the budget, when you allow the detectives' ranks to shrink from 1,200 to 700, and we didn't have a large number of detectives in the first place, now they're rapidly trying to hire back. When you decimate your sergeant ranks, so you have one sergeant for every 30 officers as opposed to one for every 10, and now they're rapidly hiring the sergeants back. When you don't have comprehensive training and redundant training to train these officers and these young officers on how to deal with the mental health patients that have been released into the community because the mayor didn't want to spend $2.5 million to keep the mental health centers open, or when officers are not being trained in de-escalation, and when you wait 5 to 6 years before you put tasers in the hands of officers and train them on how to use the tasers, what you have is you have a police force that is struggling just to hold the line, and you will have problems with accountability. And as you well know, the police officers, the police department strategy has been it's called the Violent Reduction Initiative. And Dan, what they do is, and Amy, what they do is they just move police around all over the city. So you don't have beat integrity. You don't have those officers in the community who really know the community, or for that matter, the community who knows the officers. So at the end of the day, they create conditions for these tragic events to happen. So I've laid out a very detailed plan on how I would build the officers' ranks, restore the detectives division. I've called for the hiring back of retired detectives like they did in New York and like they've done in other cities, so that they can, when your clearance rate for solving murders is 17% and shootings for 5%, I mean, you're not going to get much cooperation from the community. So I've laid out a very, very detailed and specific plan on how to increase police strength, on how to rebuild the supervision, the supervisory ranks, and on how to provide the redundant training that the police need to be effective. And I've laid out how that restoration would be paid for.
Okay, well, let's talk about that aspect of it, because I understand it's a multivariate equation and you've covered a lot of ground. But on the issue of augmenting the ranks, you know, Ron promised 1,000 more officers, never happened. If you're saying we're 2,000 officers short of where we should be, then how do you pay for those new hires?
Well, let me point out that the mayor has in his budget, I think, 13,600 officers. So he's rapidly trying to fill those positions. Unfortunately, too many officers are leaving for obvious reasons. And so when I was budget director, we had close to 14,000 officers on the street and in the schools combined. And what I would do is I would build those ranks back. And if you were built those ranks back, I'm calling for 14,200 officers. If you built those ranks back, I believe that you could in effect free up enough money by having enough officers so you weren't paying $125 million, $150 million, $175 million, depending on the year, more in overtime. Because currently, I believe in the last 7 years, they have spent $500 million more in overtime than they budgeted for. When we had police strength at at the peak levels, when I was city budget director before I became school superintendent, the most we ever spent in overtime was $38 million. And when you adjust for inflation, it's $58 million. So they're in effect paying anywhere from $100, $125, $130 million more in overtime a year simply because they're canceling leaves and they're working police for 14 straight days and they don't have enough officers. So we're paying time and a half. And it's not only costing us a fortune, it's also wearing out the officers. And a lot of these officers are dispatched to other communities that they don't know. They'll tell you that they're sitting in cars. They refer to themselves as scarecrows. So it's not like we're increasing their effectiveness. So through overtime alone, we would be able to come close. We'd be able to come close to filling those vacancies. And then I'm going to give you covering those costs. And I'm going to give you one more example. I've called for the placement of at least one police officer in every school. And what I would do is I would take the existing safety and security positions and vacancies, and I would upgrade those positions so that I was actually hiring Chicago police officers. And if you did that, it would cut the cost of the officers to the city in half because the schools would be picking up the cost of a regular security position. The city would be paying the difference. But let me tell you what that would mean. That would not only mean that our schools would be safe and secure and that you would have a restoration of the school police unit so that who were familiar with the students, who could respond to complaints, who could provide the type of safeguards that haven't been provided. But when schools are out, you would have 600 additional police officers that you could dispatch to the parks. You could dispatch to the hotspots where students gather, et cetera. You wouldn't have to pay the enormous amount of money in overtime. So I believe that plan would be very financially viable, and it would do great service in terms of improving neighborhood safety.
Speaking of the schools, again, just quickly, charter schools and the opportunity tax credit scholarships, opportunity scholarships that are coming online, positive innovations for the city? Have they been things that have improved the quality of education and choice for Chicago families?
Well, you know, I've supported charter schools, but I've never supported charter schools at the expense of traditional schools. But you know what they did, Dan? They went out and they opened like 120 charter schools. You remember Renaissance 2010, where they went in and they closed the plan was to close close to 100 neighborhood schools, dispatch the kids to different communities. If you didn't think that didn't unsettle the communities or destabilize the communities, you know, and then reopen the schools, many of those schools as charter schools. I didn't think that was a sound strategy by any stretch of the imagination. So at the end of the day, I'm all for expanded school choice, but you have to have accountability, and you can't create overcapacity because many of the problems that they're experiencing today, besides the fact that with all the uncertainty over the schools, they're significantly losing student enrollment, is the fact that they've created a system that they've contributed to the overcapacity. The second thing is I support the opportunity tax credit, and I've always supported state legislative efforts to provide support for the children of all taxpayers, regardless of whether or not where they send their kids to schools.
Right.
And I'll tell you why. Not only because I believe it's right, but I always felt that the broader the education coalition, the more effective the education coalition will be at securing the funding that all schools need. And I remember when I ran the Chicago Public Schools, we had a very, very close relationship with the Archdiocese. You know, the heyday for the communities was when both the public schools and the parochial schools were thriving, and the Archdiocese actually lobbied and supported increased funding. Edgar at the time, you remember, Dan, was trying to raise taxes to provide more money for schools, and the Archdiocese came to our defense, and they were there advocating for a better funding formula and for more funding for schools. So
Paul,
I think there's strength in numbers.
Paul, I appreciate that and your comprehensive answers. He's Paul Vallis, former CEO of Chicago Public Schools, a candidate for mayor this February, mayor of the city of Chicago. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy.
I think Paul Vallis is still talking.
Paul Vallis has a lot to say.
I'm voting for him.
That's better than giving like one sentence cliched answers. At least he's a bit of a wonk, but at least he's got details and he's thought through this and he's put together plans. I mean, he needs to perhaps package it a little bit more succinctly,
but
that's a better problem to have than the other way.
Oh, that just kept going, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was walking downtown, I think on Sunday, and I was staring at where Mayor Emanuel's office is, and I thought it's always been about him. I remember him telling me one time, I want to be the first Jewish Speaker of the House, and it was never about, I want to help the people. It's always about helping himself. And with Paul Vallis, I think that he's humble, he's smart, and I'm voting for him.
I remember when Tiny Dancer thought he was going to be the first president of the United States under 5 feet tall, and now that's not going to happen now. Your son there, Peyton, is on the cusp of playing his first varsity football game, even though he is a mere freshman.
Yeah, he's going to be on varsity.
Because he's 6'10 and 470 pounds.
No, 6'3, 200 pounds, but he is size 15 and a half shoe. And this surprised me. I did not think he wanted to play football. He's never expressed any interest in playing football. And lo and behold, defensive left tackle.
His inner rage.
Spot.
His inner rage has come out. He thinks like this, all this displaced anger he has towards you, he's channeling into the football.
Field.
That's great.
Yeah. And they play Roberto Clemente a week from tomorrow at Amundsen High School at noon. You want to go? I'm scared. I'm not a football mom. I'll become one, obviously. But
that's going to be a plane crash.
What do you mean?
Roberto Clemente?
Oh, yeah.
It's too soon. Great, one of the best baseball players.
And a good person.
Great,
very
great
philanthropic.
Man. I apologize to the Clemente family.
Yeah.
But not to Clemente High School.
Or do you want to wait till maybe the second or third game of the season, and then you want to show up? You could
see how he's – yeah, I actually probably should sign him early because he's just the size alone.
It's just big meat hooks.
Who's going to play you in the remake of The Blind Side? When
Uma Thurman.
Peyton goes from basically being homeless, living in Lakeview with his mom, a member of a local cult, and then he makes it to the NFL. Uma Thurman? Yeah. All right.
Maybe.
And
let's go.
Michael Orr could play Peyton. I like, yeah.
Kate Hudson.
So the question is, do you love Peyton?
Sometimes.
And
I always love them. It's just sometimes I don't like them.
Yeah.
Kids are difficult. Teenage boys.
Are you here? Maybe I better ask the question differently.
I am blonde, so speak slowly.
Are you willing to do what it takes to get him to the NFL?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Because he'll buy nice things for me. He'll buy me a house.
It's great. It's so selfless. It's inspiring.
Maybe he'll buy me a new used minivan.
Do you understand what it takes?
I don't.
No. Let me tell you.
Because they start recruiting, I know, in 7th and 8th grade.
Well, it's what the parents are doing in preparation for the recruiting.
Okay.
You've got to groom young men and women if you want your children to be professional athletes. And here's what's required. And this is from no less than the Wall Street Journal. Sam Schoensee, a 14-year-old in Cape Coral, Florida, has a hectic soccer schedule packed with club practices, tournaments, and one-on-one coaching.
Okay.
But his thrice-weekly 7:30 a.m. training sessions before school are easy because they take place in his backyard, where his parents, who love him, spent $120,000 to build a 93-by-40-foot professional-quality turf soccer pitch behind their home that they purchased in 2013 for $713,000, renovated for another $700,000. There, a professional youth soccer coach leads Sam and about five other players in his age in drills and other training, having the soccer pitch in the backyard with the coach before school.
That's nice. Good for them.
Technology executive Scott McNeely listed his Palo Alto, California estate for $100 million.
Yeah, what are the property taxes?
is in California is capped. The home features an enclosed ice hockey rink, 110-yard golf green, and indoor gym that he says helped develop his four sons into top college and professional athletes. Yeah. Volleyball, Amy.
Oh, I would love for a volleyball court. Can you build me one in my little backyard?
Rod Brindamore.
I mean, we can hover it over my house, build a gym up, and I could have volleyball. I could coach volleyball every day of my life.
Rod Brindamore, who has played 20 years in the NHL, spent $80,000 to install a volleyball, basketball, hockey facility with a batting cage and small putting green in the backyard of his custom home in Raleigh, North Carolina. 10 years ago, the volleyball court intended for his daughter, Briley, who is now 20, and because Rod loves his daughter, Briley, plays volleyball at James Madison University. She's a Duke.
Division I school. Nice.
Yeah. His oldest son, Skyler, who was, you know, able to practice shooting when he was home, was selected in the 2017 NHL draft by the Edmonton Oilers. Now, genetics may have something to do with this, but nonetheless.
Yes.
The practice facility at home.
You're making me feel bad.
You can't just,
in my backyard.
If you want Peyton to be playing on Sundays, you can't just sit him in front of Fortnite and go out with your friends.
No, they practice 3 hours a day. But I don't have anything in my house. I mean, should I get those tackle dummies?
You should have your house raised and replaced with a football field and use the money from the sale of the property to pay for professional coaching. Abby and Mason Phelps installed a basketball gym in their 12,000-square-foot home in Chicago's Lincoln Park.
They did?
Yeah, Lincoln Park.
They installed a basketball court in their basement? Or where?
Yeah, basketball court. Well, in their home.
In their home.
They got 12,000 square feet, so they got room. Yeah.
Well, I wonder what their property taxes are.
They didn't even have children when they began designing the home because they were thinking ahead. Now they have three, and he uses the court. But, you know, he's getting the kids involved in sports, and they'll grow up to be killers, too. That's how you do it.
What do you have for your imaginary children? Are we up to three? Or do you still have two or three kids?
I have two fictional sons.
And one on the way? Are we pregnant, Dan?
I haven't decided if I'm done having children or not. Fictional children.
Well, you know, the clock is ticking.
It is.
You might want to get up.
And I mean, I think...
you can't drag your feet on this one.
I think my eldest has a chance to play in the NBA. And I am going to install a basketball court for him.
It's time for Dan Prof's Parenting Tips. Whoa. Dan Prof's Parenting Tips. Whoa. Tell your kids to shut up and listen to him.
You're a child.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Text from 847, if Peyton did make the pros, he would be the first Sweet-A-Rican, right?
Oh, yeah. I don't know how many Sweet-A-Rican.
Especially Sweet-A-Rican defensive tackle. You don't see a lot of those. And so, wait, who do you want?
I think we're jumping the gun a little bit.
You want Kate Hudson to play you in the Blindside remake?
Better than Uma Thurman. Uma Thurman's...
Michael Orr will go ahead and play Peyton. And then are you going to keep Tim McGraw as your husband?
Yes, of course. It's hot.
All right. Holly from Hudson tweeted in, there's hope for Amy, Peyton, and Eli. Hubby and I raised three athletic kids. A golfer plays D1 club, only female on the team. Two-year captain son whose high school team won three trophies at state and a potential Division I swimmer, all public courses and Y teams. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that's sure. Okay. I still think you should liquidate your assets and pour them all into Peyton's next 4 years so he gets to Alabama and then to the pros.
Yeah. So who's filling in for me next week?
We'll have the tall, blonde John Cass on Monday.
Is he going to show some leg?
He's a snappy dresser. And then McQueary.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a surprise guest or two.
Okay.
A guest host or two.
Yeah. Well, I'm going glamping, and I'll tell you all about it.
All right. You say hi to John Thune.
Hopefully I'll run into him. Wouldn't that be awesome?
He could be your on-screen husband.
Exactly.
He's got real personality. Holy cow.
Thanks. Oh, he's easy on the eyes.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.